Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Mike Way. I wrote some stuff down. I'm getting to the age where I have to write stuff down. I got to thank a bunch of people. First, I bring you greetings from my home group, the Carolina Curie Beach Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a mistake on your menu there. It's not Cure, C-U-R-E, Beach. It's K-U-R, Curie Beach. Nobody in my home group is cured. I'd like to thank Vicki for picking me up and running ahead of me about a mile and a half while I toiled behind her trying to get up to the walk up here. I'd like to thank Matt for having the patience to live with her. I'd like to thank their daughter, Jill, for playing the harmonica while Vicki and I were trying to communicate over the phone several times. She's a talented young lady. I'd like to thank Rick for inviting me in spite of the fact that he already heard about me. I'd like to thank him for the finally going and getting the buns for dinner last night. I'd certainly like to thank his lovely wife, Linda, who's got legs to go from here to there and back again. I said, please take my seat last night at dinner. And she said, I can't. My legs go from here to there and back again. I'd like to thank their dog, Pooh Bear, for ripping my arm off. And Neil and Mary and Ann, who is going to take me to church tomorrow because I need it. And all our speakers, Ross and Denny. I had to leave Denny's meeting last night. If you're here, I'm sorry. But for 2 days before I got here, I suffered a horrendous toothache in two teeth. And I had about 4 hours sleep the two nights before I got here. I spent Thursday trying to find a dentist who would take me. So I arrived with pain going up to my ear, my eye, and I was afraid that tonight I was going to have to convince them say that I'm an alcoholic and or a gel junkie. But after I was in such pain that I knew that I was going to start screaming during Denny's talk last night. So I hit the knees, and there's a line on page 88, line 8 of the big book, the shortest paragraph in the big book, and talks about prayer, and says, it works, it really does. So I hit my knees last night, and I said, God, I'll make a deal with you. If you'll relieve this pain so I don't scream while I'm talking tomorrow night, I'll see a dentist next week. And God has never let me down. I haven't had any pain in the tooth since I woke up this morning, and I'm very grateful. Now, God always performs his part of these contracts. And now the ball is in my court, so I got to go see one of those butchers next week. I'd like to thank Charlie, who spoke this morning. I love young people in AA. We've got an AA group at home where I live in Wilmington, a young people's group. I got to tell you about them there. We got a little redheaded gal from Texas who's now there. She's 21 years old, sober 7 years. And there's a whole bunch of them like that. And they encourage us because they have, you know, Icky Paw, Pookie Paw, Nicky Paw, Nookie Paw, all those paw things. And they're a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're not separate. So some of those old geezers go by every now and then just to experience AA happening. And what they do in their meetings, I try to take it to my home group, and they say it probably won't work with us. What they do is they open the big book and they say at the beginning of the meeting, what we're going to do is read from this big book, the solution, for 15 minutes. And then we're going to discuss what we read in the book and nothing else. Now, if you've got a problem or an issue, see one of us after the meeting, but we're going to remain in the solution for 60 minutes here. You have people like Charlie in these home groups and a bunch I met in Chicago a few years ago. I believe that AA is in good hands. Thank you, young people. I'd like to thank Barb and BJ and Dawn. I don't want to thank Dawn. You decimated me. What a powerful story she has, and I was weeping. The old Irish line, you know, I'm Irish, I cry at supermarket openings, but she decimated me. And I'd like to thank Ross, who I love dearly, like a brother, like a son. And but I really want to thank Linda for giving me a spiritual haircut yesterday over at her house. She gave me less respect than I got here this evening. And that's what I needed in the middle of a toothache. And Clancy always says, you got to thank the taper. Thank you, Reggie. But what I'd really like to do before I get into my story is congratulate Tom, who read for us tonight, who is celebrating today 5 years. Congratulations to you and your higher power. A great team effort, pal.
Thank you.
I was born, some of you don't believe that. First, I want to tell you that it's amazing, and I must warn Reggie that I might go over a little tonight because this is the Lenten season. I love Lent because it's a time of pruning. And for the last 4 years, what I've done is a personal thing, except any commitments I've made to Alcoholics Anonymous, like coming here. I do not share my experience, strength, and hope at meetings for 40 days before Easter. And after 4 years, my home group breathes a collective sigh of relief. But what I learned in those 40 days is that AA gets along just fine without my input. The other thing I try to do is the thing I learned from a brilliant Indian from India, by the name of A.K. Krishnamurti. And he talks about the art of communication. And he said, in order for there to be communication, there must be a speaker and a listener. And the listener must just listen to the speaker. Not who the speaker is, but what the speaker is saying. So what I try to do is, even in my own home group where I know everybody, I've known them for years, I just listen to what they say and not who's saying it. Because after you get familiar with people, you suspect you know what they're going to say. And when I really listen, I'm wrong. Very often I've missed things that they were saying that was not, I know what Charlie's going to say. So what I do is I listen, and it's amazing what I hear. For instance, I hear some really great stuff, too. A couple of weeks ago, a girl had been sober for about 2 weeks. She came in, plumped herself down in a noon meeting. She said, oh, I'm so glad these meetings are here. Listen to this. Listen carefully, because nobody else got it. She said, if I wasn't sitting here today, I would have been dead last year. Think about that. But I knew what she meant. I love being sober. Clancy talks about alcoholism as a disease of perception. I think he's absolutely right. And Chuck Chamberlain wrote that wonderful book with a line that he stole from Bill's sponsor called A New Pair of Glasses. And that's pretty much what it was. I love being sober because now I can hear what people say and I can... Most of what we say is really stupid. Flying out on the plane, on the seat in front of me, it says, fasten seat belts while seated. Did you ever try to fasten one while you're standing up? It's really hard to do. I'm telling you, it's the obvious. Down where I live on Curie Beach, we got a lot of convenience stores that are open all night for the tourists. And we got a bumper sticker that says, we don't care how you do it up north. Well, I went in there one night. We make dumb signs. It was up in Connecticut, and they had a sign. I was speaking in the meeting, and on the right side of this side over here, it said, no smoking. And over here, it said, smoking. I thought to myself, you know, smoke probably really doesn't know how to read. I could see that down the middle aisle, there wasn't a wall of smoke over there. Why do we make signs like that? It doesn't make any damn sense. And if smoking could, we probably wouldn't give a damn anyway. Like those cloggers, I wanted to thank the cloggers. I know they're gone, but they were a wonderful exhibition of disgusting youth. And I thought to myself, in my wisdom, I get kind of, you know, psychic in my wisdom. I said, I'll bet those kids don't smoke. But anyway, I was coming to this convenience store and I was hungry and it was late at night, and they always said, things you gotta have at a convenience store on the beach is you gotta have cold beer, you gotta have cold wine, you gotta have cold Pepsi. Pepsi's a North Carolina drink. And you gotta have a hot dog machine. So I was hungry, so I stopped by the hot dog machine, and next to the machine there's a little bin, and it says on it, warm hot dog buns here. So I went to the manager. I said, what does that mean? He says, what do you mean, what does it mean? I said, Is this where you warm hot dog buns? Or are there warm hot dog buns in there? Or is that buns for warm hot dogs?
He says, won't you look inside, you damn Yankee?
You can probably tell that I have not lived in North Carolina all my life. I fly around a little bit, and every now and then they put me on one of these airplanes like coming in yesterday. It was wonderful. They're a little antique. And the good thing about them is you got a window and an aisle seat at the same time. And getting off, they got this little door. It's a little square thing about the size of the podium. And the pilot slash stewardess says, says, watch your head. I said, excuse me? Says, watch your head. I said, how do I do that? So he says, watch your step. So I watch my step above my head getting off the air. Pulled a Jerry Ford. So I love being alive, I love being sober, and I love being here in Nebraska, although I went to the University of Missouri. I bought a Nebraska hat, and I made Ross get one, too. We're both cowards. I was born 2 months and 10 days after Dr. Bob put down his last drink. My sobriety date is July 19th, 1970. A was just, had just turned 35, and I was almost 35 when I found these rooms. And it seems like there was a long time between. I would love to just tell you my sober log, but I gotta qualify myself, so I will. I had some heart surgery a couple years ago, and I had a couple months given free. I was given 2 months off without pay to recover from the state of North Carolina. And I had some time to do a lot of reading of the big book and really getting into it. And I had some other stuff I read, too. One of them's the big book. And as a good Catholic, I always keep the good Protestant Strong's Concordance and a King James Version of the Bible because I happen to love the beautiful English in it. And I was sitting there doing some comparing, and I was thinking about when did alcohol really become important to me? And it was at age 6. Now, I don't remember my first drink because I grew up in a drinking family. Some of us were chatting this afternoon. I used to get the medicine for coughs in those days when I was a little kid in the 30s and 40s was bourbon mixed with either blackstrap molasses or brown sugar if there's none of that available, and it was heated. And man, I just couldn't wait to get a cold, you know. My sister loved it too, and if you leave it on the radiator all night, it turns into candy, and you can eat that the next day too. But we tried to drink as much as we could, and it put you to sleep. It did nothing for the cough, but it certainly put you to sleep. And the same philosophy held true at Christmas time. My grandfather was a druggist in a little town in northern Wisconsin, not too far from Sheboygan or Green Bay in that area along Lake Michigan. In this little town called Keel, he was a local druggist. And he had a house that had what I thought was a great stone fireplace. Well, it wasn't a great, but when you're 3 feet tall, it looked like a great stone fireplace. We'd go up there for Christmas every year, and the ritual then was what you did at Christmas time with the kids is you'd give them a drink, and then they'll go to sleep early, and Santa Claus can come then. So what they gave us was cognac and milk, and I was sitting next to the great stone fireplace, and they gave me a cognac and milk, and I drank it. I didn't get sleepy. What I wanted was another cognac and milk. So they gave me another cognac and milk. And at that time, I didn't give a rat's ass whether Santa came or not. You know? I stood up my full 3 feet and looked my 6'4" father right in the knee and demanded a third. At which point, he put me to bed and Santa Claus came. So that was my first recollection of it doing something different for me. And I grew up in your standard hotbed of alcoholism, the good Christian family. We were middle-class folks. And I was taught to drink like a gentleman, which I was able to do for a long time, till I was about 12 when I had my first blackout. He's back to Keel, Wisconsin, where he's visiting my grandparents. We lived in South Milwaukee. And they had what they called the Fireman's Picnic every year. They had a volunteer fire department. They would have Dusty Rhodes, and they'd have the oompah bands and parades. And in those days, in the 40s, they had served beer outside. In Wisconsin, everything, beer is nothing to drink. I mean, it's not a drink. It's what you do. And if you're tall enough to get your nickel on the bar, you're tall enough to get a beer. So the kids would save their money up all summer long. They go ride the tilt-a-whirl and puke, and ride the Ferris wheel and puke, and I drank beer. Came to in my Irish grandmother's commode right off her kitchen there, where I had been calling O'Rourke, as she used to put it. And I don't remember getting there, so it must have been my first blackout. And I came to with my head in this commode, and it was at that point that I discovered that I was a seeker of poetry and beauty and truth. Inscribed on the lip of this thing was Madoc Madoric, made of Duroc. I said, God, that's beautiful. Madoc Madoric, made of Duroc. I spent a lot of time researching other facilities looking for something like that. I found Kohler of Kohler. That was alliterative. But, yeah. American Standard, that was patriotic. But never again did I find Madoc Madoric, made of Duroc. Years ago, I had a little house up in West Virginia. I was commuting to Washington, D.C., and my sister sold the great family, the old family homestead, and she'd heard my AA story. And so one day comes this big package in the mail, and it's Madoc Madoric, made of Duroc. So I made an end table out of it. West Virginia people come and says, what the hell's that? It's an end table. Looks like a damn commode. I said, well, it is, kind of. He said, well, what are you keeping there? I said, well, my important crap. That's what I keep in there. Well, enough of this toilet humor. Let's get on with the story. You can tell I'm not wrapped real tight, but consider your committee. They brought me all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to tell you something you already know. AA works. So, I didn't have a horrible childhood. I was just born restless, irritable, and discontent. I had a wonderful mother. She was brilliant, beautiful. She looked like Katharine Hepburn. My dad was 6'4", handsome, former Marine. He says there's no such thing as an ex-Marine. One sister, who was older than I was, and spent the first 13 years of her life trying to kill me, which is what sibling rivalry with her was, eliminate the competition. Then when I turned 13, I beat her up, and that was the end of that. We got along pretty well. Talk about waiting. So, I was Catholic, and I'm not a recovering Catholic, by the way. I'm not recovering from religion. I think if you read the big book, you see that religion is a big friend of ours. Any religion. It says be quick to see where religious people are right and make use of what they offer. Well, I tossed all that religious stuff out the window a long time ago. But I hear people saying, oh, boy, and Ross pointed out to me, so I listen to Ross. Even though I sponsor him, I occasionally listen to him. He says, you know, it's funny, in AA, we read that thing, it says that resentment is going to kill us. It's a very grave thing, except when somebody says, I'm a recovering Methodist, and everybody goes, yeah, yeah. It's all right to be resentful about religion. I don't know why. But looking back, I blamed everything and everybody for my problems except myself. I went off, I had a normal childhood, you know. Lost my virginity in the backseat of a 47 Jeep, sir, at the drive-in movie. And I was assaulted by this girl. I was a victim. I live at the beach. I mean, when you got it, you got it. You know? I had to shave off my mustache. People kept calling me Mr. Selleck. You know what it's like. I live at the beach. I can't go there because the bikini girls are staring at me with their hungry eyes. There's nothing I can do about it. Oh, yeah, this is an honest program. I forgot. I slip away every now and then. But I don't remember where alcohol ever seemed like a reasonable escape to me. It was just what I did. I was I could have been here at age 14 and been very comfortable here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was ready. I never drank normally. I, to this day, can't understand why people order a glass of wine and then leave half of it sitting there. It just doesn't register with me. Talking this afternoon, I had a friend visit me a couple years ago when I lived downtown in Wilmington. And he's a normal guy, and he stayed with me for about a week visiting. He's a broadcaster, and he's with a network, and hell of a nice guy. But he bought a six-pack of that stuff, got red beer now or something. It comes, I don't know, something red. But when he went back a couple days later, I looked in the fridge, and there was one bottle of beer sitting there. I said, oh, my God, what am I going to do with that? See, because a good alcoholic doesn't throw out alcohol. It's oh, gosh, I can't keep it. Who do I know that can drink one beer? I agonize, so I don't know anybody who can drink one beer. My social life is pretty much as alcoholics, and the people I do know outside the program, I wouldn't give them a beer if they wanted one. You know? Go get your own beer. So after a week, I did the terrible thing. I popped the top and poured it down the drain. I said, damn, what a shame. Somebody could have used that. So I'm still an alcoholic. I just don't think like other people do. Well, what happened is I got in trouble. And how I got in trouble is I went off to the University of Missouri, where I majored in introduction to and minored in chug-a-lug. We had moved to Missouri from Wisconsin in the 40s. And I had moved from where, I wish Denny were here, where, because I was Catholic, he was Lutheran, and it was mandatory that you hate each other. Clancy will tell you about that. Lutherans hate Catholics, and Catholics hate Lutherans. But that's all there was. Then I moved to Missouri, and there were Methodists and Baptists. And the year before I moved there, the Ku Klux Klan shot the parish priest, so I kind of went underground with my Catholicism. Or you go to church, Michael. I'd sneak off, be an altar boy. My mother was a wonderful woman. She looked like Katharine Hepburn. And after a couple of scotches, she started talking like Katharine Hepburn. Mary, you look like Katharine Hepburn. I do, don't I? And she was a brilliant life. She taught me everything I knew about poetry and beauty and truth and music. And when I became an altar boy as a young kid, she sat down and opened a can of beer and said, you're going to learn not only the Latin, but what it means. Oh, boy. Now, you got to realize that it's selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. Not was, is. I think Bill was very careful in his choice of using the words in the book. And when I start thinking that self-centeredness was the root of my trouble, I'm in trouble. Self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. But Mother taught me how to read and understand the Latin. And that was a wonderful thing. My dad did what dads did in those days. He went off and, you know, he killed the buffalo and brought home and Mom cooked it. That's kind of the way it was then. But you take an intellect like my mother's and you think back and say, my God, in today's world, she could have probably run a couple of corporations. But she stayed home, and I always knew where Mom was. But Mom had what we'd call the Irish curse. And she did drink a little bit. A lot. Frequently. And something happened when I hit high school is that my dad left the job he had and moved to St. Louis, and Mom didn't go with him. Now, my sister is kind of smart. There had been some tension in our house for years because I think as my mother's little problem increased, what we had in my family was an untreated Al-Anon and an untreated AA-er. And the tension was pretty terrible looking back. And I was afraid. If I can tell you what I was like, is I was afraid. I was afraid of all authority. I was afraid of my dad. Now, my dad was no great threat to me. Now, he did kick my butt, okay? I mean, he was raised as an orphan. He was born in a home for unwed mothers. He took the name Way, my last name, when my sister was 12 and I was 10. He did the legal paperwork himself because he wanted his children to have a real name. He didn't know who his father was. And he didn't have a father. So, obviously, he wasn't going to have great parenting skills. And the way he was brought, I asked him, why did you take the name away? And he said to me, son, that was a man my mother was living with when I grew up who didn't beat me up too bad. So that's where he was coming from. So when I would get beat up, it was because that's all he knew. I didn't know that then. But I was physically afraid of my dad for a long time. I'm going to talk about him again later. Because he took himself from nothing to a man who was a corporate executive, a man who later in his life ran his own business, a man who left the marriage for another woman when I was 21 years old, a man that I had real trouble communicating with. Their marriage broke up about the time I met Elizabeth. I was going to the University of Missouri, majoring in Introduction to and minoring in Chug-a-Lug. I have 3 hours of every major ever offered. I've got 140 hours of college credit and no degree. I'm closer to my master's than I am to my bachelor's. I joined a fraternity, and there's a lot of athletes in this fraternity, great big hulking guys, and I take them drinking. And I had a judge who was the best drinker, and the only way I could be the judge was to stay at least one drink ahead of them. I had to drive them back. Here are these giant guys puking and passing out, doing what alcohol is supposed to do. And I was driving thinking there must be something wrong with them, not knowing there was something wrong with me. I had built a tremendous tolerance to alcohol, which later was to go. So this is the way I met her. She was going to Stevens College, which was a very, very fine girls' school. Came from a very nice family. And it was a Sunday afternoon, and I was at a place called the Village, the Italian Village. I was laying under this table, and she was dancing on top of it. I fell in love. And I pursued her and got her pregnant. That's how we used to get engaged back in the 50s. And find out that the only thing we really had in common was we both drank. So there were two of us. And 8 years later, there were two of us and 5 kids. 3 girls and 2 boys. She couldn't keep her hands off me. I tell you, I've had this problem all my life. We'd had 8 kids, except she had 3 miscarriages in that time. So there's nothing worse than being an alcoholic Catholic sex maniac. I tell you, there's a whole lot of hope for you. But I loved Elizabeth. I loved her with as much as an alcoholic can love anybody. She was bright. She was vivacious. She was lovely. She loved the children, and she drank worse than I did. And my career started out slowly because of that, and then it tapered off. In the early 60s, I found myself working for an outfit in St. Louis called Sunline, and we developed a candy that became very, very popular by the name of Sweethearts. And it was hot stuff overnight. I was kind of a part of that whole thing, and these people were threatening me with a career. And success. And early retirement, that kind of thing. Well, I had to get the hell out of there. You know how it's alcoholics. So I'm up visiting my mother at the homestead in Wisconsin. We've only got 4 kids at the time. And we're sitting there. Mother is drinking her drinks and becoming profound. And I'm drinking and getting stupid. And mother's being Catherine Hepburn. And I could always tell when mom was going to get profound because she would start studying her foot. I don't know, she'd put her leg up and check her ankle out and make sure it was well turned. I don't know what it was, but I know that she was going to get philosophical at that point. That was always a kickoff point in her drinking. And she said, Michael, I said, yes, beloved mother. She said, wasn't one of your majors speech and dramatic art when you were in the university? I said, yes, it was, mom. She said, well, you know, the afternoon radio announcer at radio station WPLY in Plymouth is leaving his position to start a polka band. I said, yeah. She said, you could probably have that position if you wanted it. I said, well, I probably could, ma. She said, well, the station manager's name is Dalton Hilly. Why don't you give him a call? So I did, after a couple more shooters. And in those days, in the early 60s, radio announcers had to sound like they carried their cojones in a wheelbarrow. So that's... this guy's just...
Hello? What can I do for you?
I'd like to talk to you about the radio job.
Well, why don't you come over to Plymouth and we'll discuss it?
I said, sure.
Sorry. Blue and white smoke coming out of my car, 14 miles over to Plymouth. The whole station's about the size of the stage. It's a 500-watt daytimer, country and western in the morning, and polka music in the afternoon. So I throw down a couple more shooters and go inside, and Mr. Hilly says,
and tell me, Mr. Way, what makes you feel that you're qualified to work in this particular broadcast modality?
I said, well, sir, I read and speak English.
He says, that's better than I've got now. Can you start Monday? That's how I broke into the wonderful world of broadcasting. I stayed there for 30 years, and I was never sorry that I did, because all of a sudden I was getting paid for having a good time. But our marriage was having problems. Elizabeth was doing her thing, and I was doing mine in different places. She was staying drunk at home, and I drank with the boys. Now, Elizabeth was... Got any Al-Anoners here besides Don? You'll understand, if you're an Al-Anoner, that Elizabeth and I both needed AA and Al-Anon. I would come home and kick down the front door and say, you've been drinking, haven't you? She would hide her booze in the dandy-dighty diaper thing. We didn't have Pampers in those days. Down in there, and I would go there very proudly because I knew where she was keeping it. I pulled my sleeve up, reached down in the dandy... Yeah, I bleached my arm up to the elbow. Pull it. Listen to this, Alan Honors. I would go over to the sink, uncork it. No, she didn't have it corked up. Unscrew the top of that cheap vodka. And pour down the drain the drink I was desperate to have myself. And then I would pass out. She'd go through my pockets, get what money I had left, go get some more, and they start over there. It's just the kids standing around. 2-year-olds, oh, good, in 2 years I can go to kindergarten and get the hell out of this zoo, you know. Oh. My mother got sick, and I went over to visit her and put her in the hospital, and they opened her up and closed her up and said, try to make her comfortable. You see, by this time, I was a very important broadcaster. I was doing radio in one town and television in another, and I was drinking back and forth. Liz was home drunk with our fifth child, who almost died. I won't get into all that, but it was a mess. It was just a mess. But you see, I was too important to help my mother, so I called my sister, who had just had her first child. I had five. And she came up and helped my mother into the next world. And at the funeral, somebody said to me, you killed her. You and Elizabeth killed her, the way you live your lives. I've got to tell you something about ego. There's something about me as an alcoholic that if I couldn't be the best by my own judgment, that I must be the worst. I couldn't just be normal Joe. See, it's not in my alcoholic mentality to just be a normal, average guy. I'm happy to tell you that I'm a common garden variety drunk today, and that was a step up and a step down at the same time. But I accepted that guilt even though my mother died of cancer, because, you see, it gave me power over life and death. And I needed that so I could really beat myself up. I was in AA for 2 years before I could grieve my mother's passing. I had to learn how to do that. I had to learn how to let myself have feelings that I had suppressed all those years from the drinking. You can probably guess, I won't go into the amounts I drank. It doesn't make any difference. Not how much, not how often, it's what it does to you. And it did. It robbed from me all the chances I've had of having a productive youth. It turned me into everything that I detested. I was brought up with a great sense of values. I traded every one of those values in for alcohol, like Cross was talking about. We did the same thing. Most of us do. I became a liar, a thief, a cheat, a bad check artist, a wife abuser, a child neglecter. By wife abuse, I mean it was mostly verbal. But over the years, one scene has remained in my mind. As I was taking Liz's inventory, she'd been drunk for a long time, and so had I, but I drank with the boys, so I was okay. She hid hers, so she wasn't okay. Her alcoholism almost killed me. I could see hers, and I refused to see mine. And I drag her in front of a mirror and I say, take a look at yourself. I was half in the bag when I did that. The thing I remember is that she didn't look at her. She looked at me in the mirror, and I looked at her in the mirror. Both of us thought we were looking at the problem. Neither one of us knew what the problem was. We both had alcoholism. It was killing us, and eventually killed our marriage. She got real sick when our baby got sick, Eddie. Came down with a very rare lung disease called the Hammond-Rich syndrome, which fortunately we were in Marshfield, Wisconsin. And they have the Marshfield Clinic there, which is one of the finest teaching hospitals in the country. They traded doctors and information with Mayo. So here's this drunken couple. God is watching out for us when we have just given up on him. And they discovered that he was the youngest case of the Hammond-Rich syndrome ever discovered. And as a result of that, there are a lot of kids alive today who wouldn't have been if they hadn't discovered it that young. Normally, they didn't live to be 12 years old, and they weren't discovered that early. As a result of that, there's a lot of kids walking around today that wouldn't have been if Eddie hadn't been discovered as having that. We were in the right place for the wrong reason. And God used that moment to not just help our family, but many, many others. Eddie's 32 years old today. Just left the Navy after a career in the Navy. He needs his program. Doesn't have it yet. But I'm keeping a seat warm for him. And he knows it. My love for Eddie does not require that he gets sober. And I want to thank Al-Anon for that. I promise not to tell an Al-Anon story, but I have to. Because I love Al-Anon, but I got to tell one Al-Anon story. I stole it from a Franciscan priest. It wasn't Al-Anon. I turned it into one. It has to do with Pat and Sally O'Malley. Sally had been in Al-Anon for many, many years, and Pat never quite got the program. And Sally one day detached with love so far that she detached right out of the picture and died. And she showed up at the pearly gates, and St. Peter was there. He said, "Sally, it's nice to see you up here." She said, "Well, thank you, Peter. It's nice to be here." He said, "Sally, you just don't walk into the pearly gates." She says, "I don't, do I not?" He says, "No." "Well, what must I do?" she says. "Well, you've got to pass a test." "And what's the test, Peter?" He says, "Well, Sally, you've got to learn, you've got to spell something." "And what is the word?" He says, "Love." "No problem. L-O-V-E. He says, "Well, come on in, Sally." He says, "By the way, I know you've been in Al-Anon for a long time. I got some business to do, and you picked up on the deal. You can run the gates of heaven for a while because you're an Al-Anoner." She says, "I can probably do that, yes." So she turns around, who's there but Pat? She says, "Patrick, what are you doing?" He says, "Well, Sally," he says, "at the wake," he says, "I was so taken with sadness at your passing. That I was so sad that I stopped by O'Malley's pub on the way. And on the way home, a tree jumped out in front of me car, and here I am." She said, "Well, Patrick, you just don't come into the gates." He said, "Oh, I don't." She says, "No, you must pass a test." He says, "Well, what's the test?" She says, "You have to spell a word." He says, "Is that right? And what's the word?" She says, "Czechoslovakia." My in-laws came up to pick up my wife and five kids and brought them down to North Carolina. Things were just collapsing up there in Wisconsin. And I called my dad, who ever this time was living in St. Louis, and he wired me enough money to get a bus ticket to come down to North Carolina. I quit my job in radio and television up there and just came down with everything we owned, left another house full of furniture. You know how it is. You move every time the rent comes due. And I drank the money and hitchhiked down, arrived in North Carolina in 1968 in the back of an empty tobacco truck. And 2 weeks later, I was the 11 o'clock drunken newsman on Channel 6 in Wilmington, where I live now. Now, that was fun. Sent Liz to a rehab, which she failed with my help. And Al-Anoners will understand this, too. She came out of rehab beautiful, eyes sparkling, alive, and uncontrollable. The pain of her sobriety And my not being able to control her, the fear of that, because I knew what she was going to do drunk, was not anywhere near as painful to me as the pain of watching her kill herself by drinking. That will only make sense to an Al-Anoner, I think. And I helped her get drunk again, and I was happy. My drinking buddy was back, and we were dying together. Well, I went to work after I... Liz burned down a place down at Carolina Beach we were living in, and things got a little hot for us. So, and, you know, when you're drunk on television, it's really hard to get by with it. People begin to raise their eyebrows.
Pretty thing. I can see
you. So I went back to radio. You can fake it on radio. And I got a job up in New Bern, North Carolina, as the morning drunken disc jockey on WRNB, which was a rock and roll station. It was fun. And I'd pass out at night and hit the floor running, 5:30 in the morning, you know, turn the station on, throw it out. Okay, everybody, let's rock and roll, and then puke in the wastebasket. It was fun. Guy comes at 9 o'clock, says, I'm not going in there. Finally, I was given what I call primitive intervention therapy. Bill Jeffrey, my boss, came in one day with a stack of bounced checks from various saloons around town and says, Mike, you're going to have to do something about your drinking problem. I said, oh, no, Liz, we'll fail rehab. He says, no. What looks like is your shaky signature is, he says, I've been in this town a long time and I've got a good reputation and people are letting me know that you're kiting checks in saloons all over town. You're going to have to do something about your drinking problem. And I said, well, what if I don't? He said, well, three things are going to happen. A, I'm going to beat you into insensibility. B, I'm going to fire you. And three, I'm going to have you thrown into jail for misappropriation of corporate funds. Well, dear hearts, no one had ever explained alcoholism to me that clearly before. Our radio station was in the Sturdy Bank, was in the Holiday Inn, and down in New Bern, and I'd been in the Sturdy Beggar Lounge several times. I'd pooped my pants in there twice the week before. And lo and behold, I found myself in the coffee shop. I didn't know they had a coffee shop. And sitting across from me was a guy who was about 6'7", weighed 147 pounds, looked like a swamp crane, by the name of Jack G. Now, he spoke Southern, so I knew there was something wrong with him. And he'd been a liquor salesman, was sober for 14 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and was currently a used Cadillac salesman. He's sitting there drinking coffee, and I'm throwing coffee. I was thrown out of a saloon in Houston, Texas one time, very nicely. The bartender came over and said, careful, sir, some of that's getting in your mouth. You know, with an insult like that, you've got to leave that establishment and never come back. So here I am throwing coffee all over this place, and guy, you know, I had quit going to church, I'd quit doing anything, but people were always pointing at me. Did you notice that? When it's all about you. If I got any more self-centered, I would have imploded. My alcohol isolated me from... Everybody was them. My wife, the kids, everybody was them, and they didn't understand. I stand there smelling like a brewery with poop in my pants, my kids terrorized, my wife hating me, and be totally upset because there I stood reeking, stinking, blasphemy coming from my mouth and thinking in my head, don't pay any attention to this. Don't you understand I'm really a neat guy in here? That's kind of the way I was. I mean, it was not in touch with reality. I was a sick puppy. So after Jack G talked for about 5 minutes, I said, my God, he told me about him. Not about me, thank God. He followed the book. 5 minutes in, I said, my God, that's alcoholism. Liz has that. Another 10 minutes, I said, oh, my God, so do I. And I became on fire for AA. I'm going to talk about God for a minute, the same God that is letting me talk tonight without a toothache who will probably give it back to me about 15 minutes after I'm through. But I'm talking about a God who took a guy who could not only not drink, could not hold the thought of not drinking. And from that moment, on July 19th, 1970, talking to another alcoholic, to this moment, I have not had a drink of alcohol. Here is a God who struck an arrogant, drop-crotch alcoholic dry, not sober. That came later. The same God who months later, this arrogant guy, prayed a prayer to whom it may concern. Prayer was answered. So here we got an all-powerful God with perfect humility. The scripture says, my ways are not your ways, my thoughts are, thank God. Although I'm Catholic, I've always been an admirer of Billy Graham here. Did you take a good look at Bob? He looks just like Billy Graham. I'm sitting here trembling. I know he's going to stand up and say, you've been sinning. And he's right, I've been sinning. I've heard this higher power that we talk about, and I'm big on what I call the Old Testament in the big book. I sponsor guys. Sometimes I don't know if we're doing the newcomer a favor by reading a portion of chapter 5, because a lot of people think the book starts at chapter 5. And the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, more about alcoholism and we agnostics, is all about step 1 and 2. So when we read those ABCs, A, step 1, that we're alcoholic and couldn't manage our lives, B, step 2, part 1, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and C, step 2, part 2, that God could and would if he were sought. The next line is being convinced. We were at step 3. Newcomers, where in the hell we do step 1 and 2? In a doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. That's where we did that. So I take my guys from the beginning. I tell you why I do that. I've been sober about 3 months in AA. And a bunch of hairy-legged guys with no education who are much, obviously not anywhere near as bright as I was. Went through the 4th grade and talked funny. Sitting over to the little converted Holy Roller Church where they met. Al-Anon's owned it. Reading, Charlie V come up and she's, what are you reading here, college boy? I'm reading a portion of chapter 5, how it works.
Is that right?
College boy. What does it say on a dust jacket at their book? Down to bottom. He says, this is the basic text. So, oh, what's a text, is it? Where do textbooks begin? Oh, I see. So they got a page 1. Wrong, he says, Yankee. He says, this here book belong. It begins at page B, goes to B, I, B, double I, V, triple I, X, X, I, and so on, until you come to triple X, and then your Yankee ass comes to page 1 once you start at the beginning. I'm standing here sober today because that was one of the many singular graces of God in my life. My next singular grace came because I thought the first step was getting the car Yankee. You know, we didn't have. They drew straws. I didn't know this. You know, today they say, "Well, are you going to choose a sponsor? Find one who's simpatico." Oh, come on. You know, yes, we're both philatelists. Well, shame on you. They didn't tell me about sponsors. They just sponsored me. But I was so despicable that three of them took turns. I go to Charlie B. with a sponsor. He says, don't poke me, Yankee. It's ain't my week. Go see Mac. Here's another way the Al-Anon screwed us up. Liz and I had been drunk for years. They suggested that we go to 90 meetings in 90 days to different meetings. 90 meetings. You don't understand. We're parents. All of a sudden, we became parents. Now, when Liz and I met, you know, there probably was, if we'd have done some counseling, you know, we probably wouldn't have gotten together. Although I loved her dearly. We were both needy, needy, alcoholic kids. And you see them in AA. You can tell them, like, when they come in. Needy Jane comes in, she's got a track record of 41 disastrous relationships. You can tell she's needy. She's wearing purple eyeshadow and hot pants. In January, and Needy Joe comes in. He's got a ponytail, a brass ring in his eye. He's wearing a tank top so his muscles and his tattoos show. And they see each other. And the spark happens. This was made in heaven. The sponsors are going, oh, God, oh, gee. God. But we're different. Made in heaven. They're using God as a pimp. I mean, what's going on here? We have the classic case of two ticks and no damn dog, you know. Well, that was Liz and me. Well, these, you know, and what happened is the Al-Anon women came over and babysat so we could both go to meetings. Thank you. We got sober. And 2 years later, I learned of... I was sober. I talked about singular graces of God. I was complying. I was hanging around with these winners. These three guys would take me everywhere to meetings. They would talk AA all the way down. Big book stuff, 12 and 12 stuff, big book stuff, as Bill sees it. My head swimming. We go to a meeting. I was not allowed to talk, going down or at the meeting. Coming back, I would be quizzed. I failed every quiz. So when Linda gave me a spiritual haircut yesterday, I said, this reminded me of the good old days. Because what they knew is what I needed most was ego deflation at depth. And they loved me enough to do it for me. And I was repeating the stuff that they said as though I knew what the steps were all about. And I was doing the steps half-heartedly. I was complying because I hadn't really had it happen. The day I was sober 9 months, I was supposed to pick up my little green chip then. Why do we call it the green chip? Because it's green. You know, good God. Yeah. I was filling in for one of my disc jockeys. I must tell you one of my other jockeys. That's Ronald McDonald on weekends. When I was drinking. You know, you got to have some money. I had the nose on and the yarn here, and it's July, and the gloves on and big red shoes about that big. And kissing, Mommy, Rebel smells funny. So, you know, after 72 hours without drinking, I was alcohol free. I was nervous. But I remained spiritually and emotionally toxic for a long time. And on the day I was filling in on my 9 month, I was supposed to pick up a chip that night. I was playing something by the Moody Blues. And God revealed to me in a flash my dependence on alcohol all the way back to the beginning. I said, oh my God, I really am an alcoholic. And I fell to my knees, thanking God for that information. Somebody would come in and say, oh God, he's drinking again, take him away. Moody Blues, the night in white satin, I'm glorified to Jesus, you know. But at that point, something really radical happened. I figure I consider it a singular grace or a mercy from God. Because with that knowledge, I owned my disease. It was mine. I had it. I had alcoholism. It no longer had me. I went back to Charlie and Mac and all the boys. I said, I'm ready to do the steps now. And they pistol whipped my Yankee butt through the steps. And things went very well. My boss stopped hollering at me. You know, it's amazing how his personality changed when I got sober. I discovered I had 5 children, and I learned all their names. Ross and I have a buddy up in D.C. He's a wonderful, wonderful spiritual guy. But I remember when he first came in, he was in the young people's group. And he said, he was into everything. Very successful artist. And he says, this is exciting. He said, man, I just went to my first family Thanksgiving sober, man. He says, great. He says, I could remember the names of all my nieces and nephews, Jane and Billy. Two years into our sobriety, I finally got around to the 9th step with my wife, Elizabeth. She said, I'm glad you brought it up. What I want from you is for you to leave. When she hated me, I got off on that. You know, because I knew that hay was just love gone over the edge a little bit. Thin line. Thin line. But she said to me, I do not love you. Oh, God, that's different. That's really different. I have been prepared by my sponsors because I'd like to dwell a little on the eighth and ninth step, because what I consider the eighth and ninth step is not looking for forgiveness. I consider these justice steps. This is a part of my sobriety where I learn to grow up and take responsibility for my life, my prior life, and my present life. And what I'm going to do when I go to these people is not say, here's what I'm going to do for you. I go and say, what is it you would have me do to make things right? And if you're not properly prepared, don't go. If you have resentments, don't go. The 12 and 12 is very specific. Why not forgive them one and all? And in working that eighth step, I said to myself, you know, I learned something about forgiveness in the fourth step. And I had my eight-step list. By the way, those you poor people went to rehab and did the fifth step and said, now let's burn your fourth step. God, I want your eight-step list. But that's cool because you always do another one. And then the eighth step, we looked very, very carefully. But what I discovered was that if you're not ready, don't go. And I was prepared for whatever Liz wanted. That amends, I tell you, has lasted the rest of my life. This wasn't something I want you to give me $20. I want you out of my life. There's someone else I love, and I do not love you. I went to my sponsor at the time, Vic, one of my three sponsors, and I explained to him very carefully what was going on. I said, Vic, oh, God, pain, oh, hurt, ow, ow, oh, pain, knee, ow, pain, ow, ow, hurt, pain, ow. And Vic said to me, what an opportunity for spiritual growth. I must say to you, if you've never wanted to kill your sponsor, get a new one. Vic did not give a damn about my feelings. His job was to tell me the truth. I experienced that this morning. You know, I could tell this was a desperate young man. I came off the elevator looking old. I don't know why. And this young man said, you look like you have some wisdom. So I knew he was real new. And he explained something that he was having some, that he was new, and he was having some relationship problems. And what I knew was, I was talking to him very briefly, that I wasn't telling him one damn thing he wanted to hear. I just told him what I knew to be the truth, and it comes from Alcoholics Anonymous. And as he walked away, I could see the pain in his eyes that that wasn't what he was looking for. And I prayed if that young man is here tonight that he keeps coming back, because the solutions are in this room. We want quick fixes, and they just don't happen. They just don't happen. But if we stay sober, it will work out the way God wants things to work out. I don't mind telling you that today my life is none of my damn business. I've developed a working relationship with my higher power. I'm here because somebody asked me to. It's none of my business. I was asked to be here. I go. I have children. I must tell you what happened to my children. Liz and I split. I moved somehow. This is going to be rough. I went from a disc jockey to a radio announcer. I got a job in Washington, D.C. Little difference. I can't tell you the difference in pay between disc jockey in North Carolina and radio announcer in Washington, D.C. But all of a sudden, by the grace of God, I could pay my child support, by the way, which is not amends. Child support is not amends. That's what you're supposed to do. It's a joy and a privilege to at least help your kids stay alive, even if you can't be with them. And many years later, things developed. Things went well. And my sponsors, sons of bitches, when I got a raise, my kids got a raise. And I was delighted to do that. I could feed my kids and me very well. And then I became a radio personality. I can't tell you the difference in pay between radio announcer and radio personality. It's tremendous. And my kids got another raise. And that's where it should be. But I always wanted to make amends to my kids, but it was very hostile. They all moved to Memphis. It was hostile territory, and more hostile than it needed to be. And a few years later, I was working for Pat Robertson. This is an amazing thing. Here's a drunk who came into Alcoholics Anonymous, a walking blasphemy. 12 years later, I'm working for the Christian Broadcast Network. Some change has taken place here. And they were glad to have me. And although I had married again and my wife ran off with a junkie, that's another story. Doesn't do good things for the self-esteem. But that was 16 years ago. But what happened is right about the same time, Elizabeth had developed an eating disorder. A combination of bulimia and anorexia. A secret she'd been keeping from me when we were married and from her new husband. And she kept getting sicker and sicker, in and out of the hospital. She went to her room and she died after going back to drinking and got a Valium habit. She died slowly and very painfully. And just before she died, I discovered that this wonderful man she'd left me for had molested my three daughters. And I went to my sponsor, Moses. Moses is a wonderful man. He happens to be a black man in Washington, D.C. He's like a father and a friend to me. And I went to Moses and I said, well, Moses, because every now and then you'll lose your program. That's why we have sponsors. It all becomes about me. I went to Moses, I said, I just got one question. Do I kill him or do I have him killed? Do I do it myself or do I hire it out? And Moses looked at me in his wisdom and said, when did you become the injured party? Why don't you go out there and make a fool of yourself and get headlines and go to jail where you can be of no help to your daughters? Or why don't you consider getting them into some sort of treatment, counseling to help them through this? Duh. My two sons moved in with me. Went to Moses and said, these guys, one's 22 and the other one's 19, hasn't finished high school, he's been running drugs for his mother, and they're going to come live with me. What should I say to them? And Moses said, they're grown men. They don't care what you say. They don't even know you. They want to see how you live. Why don't you live the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? Do it. That's what sponsors are for. And I did all of those things, and I'm glad I did. I told my daughters that, please, allow the anger that you have for me to come out, and I'll be there for to receive it, because please allow yourself to be angry with me and with your mother and with that poor sick man. Because that's what he was a poor sick man. And what happened is my daughters came down to see me where I live, and they let it all out. Why weren't you there for us? Why weren't you there? Because of AA and because of Al-Anon, I was able to say, kids, I didn't know what was going on. And I was able to say, and that's no excuse. I should have made it my business. I was so busy, just happy to send money up there, that I didn't want to get involved to make sure that you were feeling okay and that your lives were going well. I just assumed, with me out of it, that everything was fine. And that was no excuse, and I hope someday you can forgive me. They forgive me then. That day, right there, lots of tears and hugs, and I have three daughters. I now have two sons. Last time, you know, in the next Christmas, they invited me up to Memphis, because I thought I'd been the perfectly terrible father. They wanted me to come up to Memphis and read A Christmas Carol to their children like I did for them. They hadn't forgotten. I wasn't a total bust. And I learned one thing. Your kids are going to love you whether you think you deserve it or not. I learned to accept love in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned to love in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I haven't been in a relationship for 16 years. My sponsors would really believe that adultery and fornication are not part of my recovery program. I think they're right. But I have some very, very intimate relationships with wonderful women in Alcoholics Anonymous. Close and intimate relationships and very spiritual. It ain't about jumping on your bones. And I wouldn't trade that for anything. I live with a guy who's John the Werewolf. He's lived with me for 5 years. He dropped acid every other day for 3 years. It said it didn't affect him any, but he's convinced he's a werewolf. Lives down at the end of a hall in the place I call In There. I don't go in there. I don't want to know what's in there. He sleeps all day. I have no idea what he does at night. But he goes to meetings. He's 18 years sober. And then Ross comes down at least every 2 weeks. And we, the three of us, sit at the table of wisdom. You can imagine what that's like. Then we get one of the young guys I sponsor down there, and they just sit there and marvel at us. You know, what is going on here? They say, you grow up, you'd be just like us. I think I'll leave now, they say. We have a great time there. And it's an AA house. We're the typical bachelors. You know, all our house plants have died, and we got green shit growing in the refrigerator. My father never loved me. Never understood me. He married her 40 years ago. The other woman, the woman I've always called my wicked stepmother. Although Irene has always treated me and mine with nothing but kindness. It was just kind of a joke, the wicked stepmother thing. But every 5 years, my sister Pat, who, by the way, is now 15 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, would go out every 5 years to Wrinkle City, Arizona, where he lived. South of Tucson. It's called Green Valley. I call it Wrinkle City. The cars, I already see his talons, you know, no heads. And for many years, I figured radio, I was doing things other than radio because after a while in radio, you discovered that although you do a lot of shtick, you know, say, I'm going to do commercials, but I'm going to say something real stupid before the commercial because I want you to come back after the commercial and say something even stupider. But basically what radio boils down to is the time, good morning, the time is, the temperature is, you're about to hear, you just heard, and now the news. You do that for enough years, you get bored. So I started doing other. One of the things that I did, probably the most worthwhile thing I've ever done with my career, is I recorded books for the blind and physically handicapped for the Library of Congress. And there are libraries all over the country. So I'm out visiting Big Ken about 12 years ago. And I look, he's got a talking book machine. You see, this man never loved me, never understood me. I said, what do you got there, Dad? He says, well, boy, you know, I don't see too good no more, so I got one of these machines. I said, well, what do you listen to? He says, you know, I like Westerns. And one of the first ones I got, in fact, the very first one I got was the one you recorded. I said, you did? Whoops. He calls me boy. He called me boy my whole life. 5 kids, 8 grandchildren, I'm still being called boy. He says, you know, you did a pretty good job on it, boy. I said, well, thanks, Dan. I said, how long have you had that? You still got the tape. What's it doing? He said, I've had it about 6 months. I said, well, you've already heard it. Why do you? He says, you know, a funny thing happened, boy. I went to take it back to the library, and they'd lost paperwork, so I just kept some bitch. That was in 1985. I said, well, Dad, why do you still have the tape? You've already heard it once. He said, well, truthfully, son, every now and then I just need to hear the sound of your voice. See, I've been wrong. I wanted everything on my terms. My dad didn't love me the way I wanted him to. He just loved me the way he did, and I call that not love. Perception was off. Right into my sobriety. My old man loved me just fine. He loved me the way he did, not the way I demanded. My dad loved me. And every Saturday morning from that day on,
he heard from me. I called him every Saturday morning. He was really funny about old people. Older than me, even. Is that they remember, they expect things. If I didn't call him at 9 o'clock sharp, my phone would ring. You all right, boy? So it was 9 o'clock sharp. And then, amazing thing happened, talk about amends. Last summer, my cruel stepmother called me up and said, look, I'm going to one of my grandchildren's wedding. Could you come out? And my dad was not doing well. He was on a walker, and his health had begun to decline, but his mind was still sharp, but he needed help physically. Could you come out and spend a week with your father while I go to... I said, I would be delighted to come out and spend a week with my father. So last August, I went out there, and Irene went off to Salt Lake City, and I spent the first week with my father that I'd spent alone with him since I was 17 years old. And I took him for a haircut, and I wiped his butt, and I fed him, and I bathed him, and we joked and sang together and had a great time. I was called to do so. That was a little amends. Early in December, my cruel stepmother called me again and said, could you come out? Your dad is going to have some surgery. And she weighed about 85 pounds. She's only 82. She's a youngster. My dad was pushing 92. And I went out there because my life is none of my business. I was going to move out there and get a place nearby and come over and help take care of my dad every day. And while I was out there, he was still in this little care center. And I would go over, and every night, because he couldn't see too well, and he was in terrible pain, and he had a back problem, and they were feeding him right directly into his stomach because his trachea, the esophagus, didn't work anymore. And he had a catheter, and he was pooping his pants. And all this had happened very rapidly because he'd been a very active man. And I went over on a Friday morning. He said, I had a revelation last night, boy. I said, what's that, Dad? He said, I can die if I want to. What do you think? I said, it's your call, Dad. He said, I'm going to go ahead and die. I said, okay. What does Irene think about it? He says, well, we'll talk about it when she comes by today. So he told her his plan, and he decided to die, which means stop feeding me directly into my stomach. He was never going to be able to get up again. And he made a decision, and he had been trembling. And after he made that decision, a couple of days later, I said, Dad, are you aware that you don't shake anymore? And he said, I'll be damned. So they gave him water, and I read his favorite scriptures to him every night, the Psalms and the St. Francis prayer that we love. And although he's an Episcopalian, he prayed the rosary every day. So I prayed the rosary with him every night. And we went out joking. And 2 days before Christmas, I knew I had to get up and get to Mass. And at the consecration, I commended my father's soul to God. And when I got to home, he had died at that very moment. Another singular grace. And we celebrated his passing. When my mother died back there in 1968, a year and a half before I got sober, I said, God, what have you done to me? What have you done to me? Why did you kill my mother? Now, how self-centered can you get? How can a loving God that I know now, why would he have the audacity to wipe out a perfectly, reasonably wonderful human being just to get my attention? Total self-centeredness. And that's the change that Alcoholics Anonymous has made. From God, why did you take my mother, to God, thank you for taking my father. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me in 28 years. A slow process. And it's different. And I love this program, and I love the people in it. I thank you for letting me be here today to share this wonderful weekend. And all the great speakers and the people I've met on the side, you're all a blessing to me. I'd like to end by sharing something that my mother taught me, a wonderful woman who never found this program. It was one of the first blessings she taught me in Latin. I'd like to share that with you in closing. Pax Domini sit semper vobiscum. May the peace of the Lord be always with you. Thank you.